Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with David Cole. David, it's great having you on.
It's a great pleasure to be on again, Robert. Thank you.
So, David, you've been writing a lot for Tacking Mag, and just tell us how has that been going so far right now. It's been a major publication that has been carrying your work.
Well, I want to give Tacky's Mag a shout-out because they're the only publication this year, actually the only publication since my outing as David Cole, that has stood by me and offered me a regular weekly spot. I've been brought in to about a half dozen publications, primarily conservative publications, to write for them this year. And very quickly, I'm usually dismissed once the trolls and the harassers and the people who don't care for me and the people who don't want me to have a platform, once they show up, everyone else folds. Tacky's is the only publication that has stood by me steadfastly, and I always like to mention that because it's very rare and it's very valuable when there's a publication that has the guts to publish controversial authors and to stand by them in the face of any criticism, both behind the scenes or publicly. So that alone is valuable to me to have a platform, and I do always want to express my appreciation for Tacky's and for the people there for standing by me. I kind of try to mix it up. I try to write about various things. I don't like to write about the same topic 2 weeks in a row. I know that I'm primarily known for writing about the Holocaust as David Cole, and back when I was David Stein, I was primarily known for writing about conservative politics. And I do try to mix it up. One of my favorite topics is the fight against censorship and the fight against political correctness. And I deal with that whenever something in the media pops up that can give me some fresh ground to cover. But that's always an evergreen topic for me. Censorship and political correctness, those are things I can write about endlessly. But I've also written about everything from global warming and abortion and gay and trans people, pretty much whatever comes to mind. There's always something in the news that will give me a spark of some kind to write about. And I try to keep it interesting for my readers.
And your recent article is Our Delicate Muslims. This was about the incident about the high school student who brought that clock to school, and he was investigated by the police and the controversy surrounding that.
Now, that became a big national issue, maybe even an international issue. I think it became a much larger issue than it should have. That's led to a lot of speculation from other writers that it might have been pre-planned. It might have been the boy or his parents might have wanted something like this to happen for either the publicity or to help groups like CARE, the Muslim group, to help them stir the pot about supposed Islamophobia. I don't know, that's not the angle of my piece. Rather, I'm trying to do my best to explore whether there is a double standard that is anti-Muslim, or perhaps there might be a double standard that goes the other way, a double standard in which Muslims get the better end of the stick, and other people, non-Muslims, or people who are white, people who are Christian, maybe they get treated worse. More people than I have pointed out the large number of non-Muslim students who have been suspended or in some cases arrested for absolutely stupid, frivolous things. I mean, these in the last couple of weeks, these stories have become very well known. They were well known to many people, myself included, before last week, because I always try to read about these kind of hysterical overreactions based on zero tolerance policies. But you have a boy who is suspended from school because he chewed his Pop-Tart into an L shape that people thought looked like a gun. And you have a boy who was suspended because a teacher found him with a leaf, and the teacher thought it was marijuana, the leaf was tested, and it was just an ordinary, regular outdoor leaf, not in any way associated with marijuana at all. But the suspension stayed. That's what was so ridiculous about that case. Even when it was proven that it was just a normal outdoor leaf, the school stood by the suspension, which is just very silly. There is a tendency, especially since Columbine and the spate of school shootings in the late 90s, there's been a tendency to go over the top with zero tolerance policies and the whole see something, say something mentality, which is not necessarily wrong, because if I were a school administrator, probably my number one concern would be not wanting any kids to get killed. And then after that, inevitably there's the concern that you don't want to get sued if kids get killed and you saw something and didn't say something. We live in a very litigious society, as everyone knows, and nobody wants to be the one who gets pinned as the goat for having missed something obvious that led to a bunch of kids being killed. So to an extent, that nervousness and overreaction on the part of school administrators, I can understand it. I don't think it always has to be blown up into a national case, but since it was, since the story of the Muslim boy with the odd-looking clock became a national story, and President Obama got involved, and Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook got involved, and Microsoft gave the kid thousands of dollars of free stuff. So since it has become a story, it's a legitimate topic to write about and to point out that what happened to that Muslim kid is absolutely no different than what happened to dozens and dozens of non-Muslim kids who didn't get tweets from Obama and who didn't get free stuff from Microsoft and who didn't get a congratulatory tweet from Mark Zuckerberg. So I'm trying to look at it from the perspective of it's very easy to cry Islamophobia, but sometimes you have to look at the bigger picture and realize that maybe you're not being targeted because of your race or religion. Maybe it's just a matter of the kind of overreactions that happen a lot in schools these days.
And I mean, there's a lot of it's like a police state environment, and there's a lot of schools are becoming like prison-like environments where there's metal detectors and there's police officers on campus. I remember when I was in high school, there were police officers on campus. This was actually at a school dance, but they started just harassing me because they said I was nervous. And I was not bringing drugs or any kind of objects that could potentially be dangerous. They were just harassing me for no reason. I mean, they were just being dicks. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of, plenty of cases where there's kids in high school and adults who are harassed by school authorities or by the police, and there's plenty of cases like this. Your point is just saying that people are selective. They're selective in picking cases that fit a particular agenda.
Yeah, exactly. And when I went to high school, I went to a majority black L.A. public school during the early 80s when the crack epidemic was pretty bad, and back when the main gangs in town were the Crips and the Bloods. The gangs are different now, and there's a much larger percentage of Mexicans and a much smaller percentage of black people in these areas. But in my day, we were kind of used to the high security because of the gang problem. There were really never any issues of any knee-jerk reactions because of concerns that anyone was going to shoot up the school or perhaps bring a bomb, because the security officers were always much more concerned about we were in Crip territory, so there was always the concern about Bloods showing up, and the security guys
was
kind of ignored.
Was this in the ghetto, or was this because of busing?
Oh, no, it was because of the area. The interesting thing about that school, Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton High School, The school was built to draw equally from a bad area and from a decent area. It was actually built to be somewhat even-handed in its student population, but that was in theory. In practice, the kids from the decent, primarily white and Jewish area, they either went to private schools or they faked their addresses or fudged their addresses a bit so that they could go to Beverly Hills High or Uni High School or one of the other better schools in the area.
I went to Uni High, but when I went there, it was pretty ghetto. I graduated in 2004, and there was a lot of busing.
I can imagine that the demographics have changed so much since 1984. I don't think I'd recognize it. I know that in my own school, it became a magnet school. Sometime in the 90s, it became a magnet school for musical theater. So that has drawn large numbers of white kids to the school. I'm sure that Hamilton's demographics are very different now. The combination of the magnet school and the general demographics of the area having changed, having become more Mexican and less black, I probably wouldn't recognize it now. I know that back in the early 80s, there were very few Mexican kids. And we had so few Mexican kids that it sort of stood out if you heard someone speak Spanish. It was something, it was not part of the normal background noise, whereas today in LA, it pretty much always is. No matter where you go, there is always a normal background noise of people speaking Spanish. But in the early 80s, it did happen at Hamilton, but it was very, very rare.
Were you bullied a lot by blacks?
No, in fact, quite the opposite. They liked me and they let me alone. I think it's because I was entertaining, but also I think it's because I was very unimportant to them. In other words, I wasn't much of a target because the gangbangers, they were interested in fighting other gangbangers. They were interested in fighting, I hate to put it in these terms, but they wanted a fair fight. You know, they wanted to go up against somebody who they could take credit for having beaten. I was a tiny, scrawny little Jewish kid. Nobody picked on me. In fact, the only time ever that I got picked on, this is only once or twice in junior high school, was always white kids. Because if you were a white kid with the soul of a bully at that school, you couldn't pick on a black kid, because if a white kid ever did pick on a black kid, there'd be tremendous retaliation, swift and violent retaliation. And the white kids kind of instinctively knew that, and those who didn't learned quick enough that you don't mouth off to a black kid or you're going to end up beaten within an inch of your life. So the white kids who had a mean streak would come after me because I was, to them, I was an easy target, and they could take out all their bullying aggression on me. But not one time in all my years did a black kid ever treat me with anything less than respect. So my perspective is probably a little different. I've heard many stories about white kids who went to mainly minority schools, and I've heard some very ugly stories. There, many of my friends who are white, who were my age, did get picked on, but I could always tap dance my way out of any situation. The black culture is very respectful of entertainers, and if you can be funny and lively and entertaining, that actually goes a long way towards charming that particular demographic.
One thing about diversity and the police state environment is, I think in the past, you're talking the 1980s, but in the 1980s and before that, I think the police were were harsher towards blacks, but they were probably pretty much very lenient towards middle-class whites. One other thing about diversity and quote-unquote egalitarianism is that what's happened, and it's not so much that the police have treated blacks more fairly, but that everyone is now sort of equally treated badly by the police state. And I've noticed that was one of my observations in both middle school and high school, is the school authorities have to deal with a lot of tough gangbanger types, but because of political correctness, they can't single them out, so they have to sort of treat everyone the same. So if you're like, if you're someone who's totally harmless, a lot of cases like the school, the disciplinary environment will treat you just as bad.
That's a fascinating perspective, Robert. That's really interesting. I've never heard somebody put it that way, because you know, this is stuff that happened after my time. And that's a very interesting perspective, the notion of having to appear to be fair, so you go after the you go after a white kid if you've done something to go after a black kid. That's really interesting. It reminds me of something I was told by a couple of lawyers back in, I think, around 2003, 2004, when Ernst Zundel, the Holocaust revisionist, when he was in prison in Toronto, he had been slapped with a security certificate. That is something that they have in Canada, that their version of, they kind of have a combination FBI-CIA, that is one organization in Canada. And the government can issue a security certificate against somebody, which basically means you're thrown in prison, but with no charge and no trial. This detention center in Toronto after 9/11 kind of became a Guantanamo Bay, but in the center of Toronto. And what I was told when I was trying to get Zundel out, when I was trying to work for his release, lawyers for other people who had been slapped with security certificates, other people who were in the same position, they told me that Zundel had only been treated that way because every other person who had been slapped with a security certificate was a Muslim. And the government felt they had to do it to a white person in order to appear fair and to deal with all the outcry from the Canadian Muslim community. So in Zundel's case, he spent 2 years in a 6-by-10-foot cell, primarily because the government wanted to look fair and not look like it was only going after Muslims. So it's interesting what you're talking about from school is kind of a similar principle of the police state wanting to appear fair.
Well, I'll tell you a particular story that sort of demonstrates that. So I went to an elementary school in the Westwood area that was mostly white and Jewish. And then for middle school, I went to Emerson Middle School in Westwood, which had a lot of black kids bussed in. And I went to use the restroom. This is when I was in sixth grade. And I mean, I was really tiny back then. I just imagine me being like 11 years old going to the restroom. And just all these black kids poured in, and because there was a fight in there, and then the vice principal, who was this black guy who was kind of like a prison warden type, came in there, and he pushed us all in there, and he questioned everyone, he verbally abused everyone, someone was complaining about the air, and then he's like, oh, you can suffocate and die, and it was, obviously I should have been let out, but in that environment, they have to treat everyone equally who was there, because he was punishing them for being spectators of a fight, and I just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, I can see that happening, and I'll tell you, in my instance back in 84, I got away with a lot of stuff. Frankly, I did some things when I was in high school that I shouldn't have done. I mean, stuff always in an attempt to be funny, but stuff that verged on pranks that involved vandalism, that involved defacing some school property, being in school after hours doing stuff. As I said, always pranks just for the sake of being funny. But I got away with a great deal, and the security and the administration turned a blind eye to most of what I did. And I think primarily it was because I'm only guessing about this reason, but I think it was because I was the only student who was bringing trophies to the school for the theater department. And I think they cut me a lot of slack for that. But generally, from my memory in those days, you could get away with anything except something that appeared to be gang-related, at least at Hamilton. That was the only thing everybody was on guard about. But generally, other stuff, smoking, drinking on campus, things like that. It was a very lax environment. I'm sure it's very, very different now, but it was very lax from 83 through 86.
I mean, I even remember as a kid in like the early 90s before, this was before Columbine happened, like going around, like playing with friends with like toy guns. And now like parents are very, like tell their kids there's like zero tolerance, like for having a toy gun in public.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I remember the days that there was a period back in the early to mid 80s when toy stores sold very fairly realistic looking water guns that were shaped like automatic weapons and had a tremendous range. They could shoot water much further than your average water pistol, and they were black and they didn't have the giveaway red tip at the end of it, I know those are long off the market, but yeah, I remember being able to have those back around 84, 85, and it's almost unthinkable that those types of things would be sold or allowed in schools now.
So you've been writing different articles about the Muslim issue. Has this curried you any favor with those conservative types who banished you?
Unfortunately, no. I still don't get carried by them, no matter what I write about. And it's there are several reasons for it, of course. That Holocaust revisionism is the kind of thing that even the whiff of it, even the taste of it, a lot of sites are going to steer clear of. When I was outed, I had sites pull my work, pull everything I had written as Stein, even though nothing that I wrote for them was about the Holocaust. But my stuff was still pulled, was still scrubbed, because of what they see as Holocaust denial, and they didn't want me involved. But another reason that conservative sites are never going to carry my stuff is that the beef that some of the people, like with the Friends of Abe organization and the local GOP, the beef they have with me is personal. It goes beyond Holocaust denial. There are a couple of people with some decent clout, primarily Michael Walsh, who writes for the National Review, and PJ Media. This guy despises me on a level that would normally be reserved for the Phantom of the Opera haunting an opera house taking revenge. He's got a deep internal hatred, and so he's always out there making sure that my stuff doesn't get carried. And I hear from editors, I hear from people who say, we'd kind of like to carry your The reason that a lot of conservative sites don't want to carry my work goes beyond ideology, goes beyond just a desire to not be seen as entertaining a Holocaust.
The thing is, you don't fit that stereotype. I mean, like I pointed out, you also write a lot of articles criticizing Islam, and that's the kind of stuff that mainstream conservatives like to hear.
Yeah, I'm still politically pretty conservative at heart. In other words, my views didn't change with my outing. I think there was a belief some people had when I was outed where that they thought, oh, when he was David Stein, he was just pretending. He was just pretending to be a conservative. He was just pretending to be a Republican Party guy. And I always point out to those folks that I was David Stein for 18 years. That's a long commitment to a bit. If that was a put on, nearly 20 years. By that point, I think people should say, okay, maybe he was not putting us on. Plus, I didn't want to be outed. So that was not my decision. It certainly was not my desire to be outed. So everything that I wrote as Stein represented how I feel. Definitely there were times when I amped up the rhetoric, when I did write for sites like Breitbart and some of the other popular conservative sites. I mean, that there were certainly times when I trumpeted a story that maybe I felt was not an earth-shaking story, but I knew that the Breitbart readers would like it, and I knew that, or the readers of Front Page Mag or any of those other sites. But I never wrote about something that I didn't genuinely have interest in, and I never wrote about something by lying about my beliefs. The stuff I wrote as David Stein, I still stand by everything that I wrote, and I've always been very critical of elements within the Muslim community and Muslim culture. One of the things that people can do, they can go back and they can look at every single word I ever said and every single word I ever wrote as David Cole in the late 80s through 1995, and I never got into the whole anti-Zionist, I'm on the side of the Muslims thing. I never did that. Frankly, I avoided the issue because it was irrelevant. And one of the things that I always try to explain to people as a Holocaust revisionist is that I keep that separate from politics, period, because you don't have to be conservative, liberal, pro-Zionist, anti-Zionist. You don't have to be anything in order to understand what Holocaust revisionism is. It's about facts and documents, and you can believe whatever you want and vote for whatever political party you like, and it's a separate thing. So I did try to keep politics and Middle East stuff out of what I wrote as a revisionist, but at the same time, I got very, very upset every time I would be called an anti-Zionist Jew. I primarily got upset because people would call me that without knowing anything about my views. Back in 91, 92, before email, I would write letters or I would talk to people in person. I remember in one instance back with the Spotlight newspaper, used to be weekly. I don't know if it still comes out weekly, but the Spotlight.
Is that affiliated with IHR?
Well, yeah, with Willis Cardo and the Liberty Lobby that created IHR but then split from it. And so while it all comes from the same thing. And when I was in the mix back in the early 90s, it was the same thing. The Liberty Lobby, the Institute for Historical Review, and the Spotlight newspaper were all part of the Willis Cardo empire. And the first time that Willis Cardo ever wrote about me, he said that brave, young, anti-Zionist Jew. And I would see him every couple of weeks, and the next time I saw him, I said, you don't know anything about my Middle East views or my politics. Don't call me anti-Zionist just because you assume that every revisionist has to be anti-Zionist or that every Jew who writes about revisionism has to be anti-Zionist. It has nothing to do with Israel. I mean, politically, sure. I'm just talking about the historiography. The historiography is isolated. It's separate from anything else. People have used the Holocaust for every number of political purposes, including on behalf of Israel, and that's a fact. But I'm talking about as a historian. The historiography has nothing to do with your belief on anything or about anything. So I would tell people like Cardo to cut it out and to not try to assign a label to me about what I do or don't believe. And so there are a couple of instances from the early 90s where I was called that, and then it never happened again because I would always try to speak to people and tell them I'd write, as I said, I'd either write letters or I'd see them in person. I'd tell them not to do that anymore. Once I fled the scene, though, I no longer defended myself or communicated with that old clique at all. So stuff just started to get written about me from 95 onwards, and I just let it happen. I didn't even really pay attention. What I found out after my outing was that there was a whole generation of people who had built up an idea about who I am or who I was, people who were not around or following this in the early 90s, but who subsequently encountered my work on YouTube or they just came up with this idea about who I am that was not always correct. There are people who had taken some of my videos, some of the documentaries I did and some of the TV appearances that I did in the 90s, and there are people who had taken them and done narration over them, their own narration, or added their own captions. And a lot of people who saw that in the late 90s, early 2000s, mid-2000s, a lot of people who saw that assumed that was me. Like the video, the documentary that I simply titled David Cole Interviews Dr. Franciszek Pieper, that was the name of it. That's the only name I ever gave it. But you can find it on YouTube with titles like, I think somebody uploaded it with the title, What Holocaust? And I think another one, a Jew destroys the Holocaust or something like that. People have just had, you know, they've had fair game with all of my stuff because I was never there and I was never interested in correcting them because I was out. I was out of that circle. I was out of that, that was not a part of my life anymore. I was very surprised when I came back and I saw the mess that a lot of people had made of it over my absence. But I had nobody to blame but myself for that because I took myself out.
So do you think Ann Coulter will survive her recent comments she made?
That's a good question. And Ann Coulter is always purposely divisive. That's kind of her thing. She likes being a lightning rod. She also likes to change up what she gets outraged about. After 9/11, it was all Muslim, 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 Muslim. You know, anti-Muslim, anti-Muslim. We should invade their countries. We should convert them to Christianity. And for a while after 9/11, every lightning rod controversial thing she said was directed against Muslims. Then eventually she sort of transitioned to immigration and everything became Mexicans, Mexicans, Mexicans. And it was almost like, okay, the Muslim thing, yeah, I'm not interested in that anymore. I find that childish. I do kind of find her to be childish in that way. Like when you look back, she in the past, some of the things she's written about being anti-abortion, and that was very important to her, no abortion, no abortion, no abortion. And then with Donald Trump and his views on immigration, she said, I would be fine with him doing abortions in the White House as long as he stops immigration. So right now her shtick is immigration, and because her shtick is immigration and she's very pro-Trump, she is therefore anti the other candidates and very hostile to the other people in the primary on the GOP side. And so whatever, when some of them started speaking about Israel this, Israel that, at the last debate, somewhere in that complex brain of hers, she decided to tweet something that I'm sure she knew would put her back in the headlines. But I just think it comes from her very childish sense of just adopting new things every 5 or 6 years, some new most important thing in the world, even when the previous most important thing in the world is still a problem.
The thing is, there's writers, and I mean, I don't have a problem with Ann Coulter being a shock jock or being provocative, but she's kind of all over the place. Like, there's someone like Pat Buchanan has strong views on issues like immigration, but he has a very strong, coherent ideology that he's backed up over the years. Ann Coulter is sort of like she picks up one issue and then she feels strongly about another. That's the point you're making.
Yeah, and I agree with you about Buchanan. You can look at Buchanan's work for decades. The man goes back and he has quite a record. You can look at all of Buchanan's work and you see similar threads. You don't see that kind of capriciousness, mercurial nature that Coulter has. And I find it a little childish, and it becomes difficult to take her seriously as an intellect. I agree with you. I don't particularly have anything against someone who wants to be a political shock jock. But once you start doing that too much, people don't take you seriously. They don't take your work seriously anymore. You become like a morning DJ where people decide to listen because they want to hear the fart noises, but they're not going to take your opinion on anything political because they dismiss you for that. So she's, you know, she's dug her own situation, and I think she'll certainly survive. There will always be people who will carry her work. There will always be people who will want the press that comes with carrying her work. I mean, the same can be said with Sarah Palin, who is irrelevant, completely irrelevant. I mean, she doesn't hold political office. She isn't a great intellect as a writer. She doesn't have a syndicated column or anything like that. She doesn't even have a reality show anymore. But people still carry her work, and people still highlight every little word she says because people are the readers want to hear whether they like her or hate her. If they hate her, they want to, oh, well, what's the newest dumb thing Sarah Palin said? And then the Huffington Post will headline, look at the newest dumb thing Sarah Palin said. She may be irrelevant, but she'll always have a platform with people who dislike her as well as people who like her.
So you have this article, The Right Jewish Problem, and this was about this event where, oh, was this Friends of Abe that they hosted Mark Stein to speak at the Universal Hilton?
Yeah, that was in late August. The Friends of Abe, the Hollywood conservative, Hollywood Republican organization, they hosted Mark Stein for their summer banquet.
So you obviously weren't invited.
What was that? Sorry?
You obviously weren't invited to that.
Oh, yeah, definitely not invited. In fact, extra security precautions were taken by the staff at Friends of Abe to make sure that I wouldn't be there. For example, the Friends of Abe, they know that they still have many members who are friends of mine, and those members have occasionally been harassed or questioned as to whether they might be involved in trying to smuggle me in. I would never infiltrate a Friends of Abe event because nobody wants to, well, not nobody, I don't want to be in a room full of people who hate me. That's not something that I find pleasurable at all. But Friends of Abe was certainly concerned that I would. And the point of the article that I wrote about the rights Jewish problem is that when a guy like Mark Stein is celebrated by the mainstream right, by the mainstream conservatives and Republicans, there's always that back patting and self-congratulation about, look how brave we are. Mark Stein, he said these things about Muslims, and he said these things about gays, and he said these things about Mexicans, and now we're honoring him. We're brave. We're anti-PC. We're fighting the PC police. But there's a line that is drawn with the mainstream conservatives where they won't say anything that might offend Jews. They're fine to say something that might offend Muslims or that might offend gay people or that might offend Mexicans or other Latinos. They're fine with that. But the minute the slightest whiff of something that might be offensive to Jews, the minute that comes up, these brave people pack up their tents and scamper away like frightened little monkeys. And I was trying to bring some attention to that because I thought people should know that these same people, these exact people at Friends of Abe who were patting themselves on the back that night about how brave they are in giving a platform to Mark Stein, these are the same people who not only banned me from the group for my views, but also who to this day still try to prevent me from having a platform. And so I thought that hypocrisy was something people might be interested in because when you have that kind of selective bravery, well, then you don't have any bravery at all. You're not really the anti-PC force in the world that you think you are if there's one group that you keep protected. That's why, getting back to what my Tacky's columns are, I'll say things that are offensive pretty much to any group, including Jews, but also white people, Mexicans, Muslims, Christians, gay people, whatever. I'm totally fine with that. I'm not the only one. There are other writers who are equally even-handed in who they will criticize. But the mainstream conservatives and the mainstream GOP, like Friends of Abe, they're very, very frightened and very cowardly when it comes to anything that they think is offensive to Jews. And, of course, I would make the point that I don't even think Holocaust revisionism is offensive to Jews. It's simply a matter of fact, and I could be right, I could be wrong, but I'm not making a moral judgment on anybody. I'm not passing any kind of judgment on any particular group, any race, any religion, any ethnicity. I'm simply talking about historical facts as I see them. And if I'm wrong, I always invite people to tell me I'm wrong. But yeah, this hypocrisy, this Jewish problem, as I put it in the title of the piece, I thought that somebody with a background in Friends of Abe should speak up about it.
Mark Stein's an interesting person because on one hand, he's expressed a lot of views that are very much in line with neoconservatism. He embraced the neoconservative foreign policy in the Middle East. He was regularly invited on Fox News. But some of these quotes you said are something that are very much, they're similar to what you would hear, they're very similar to white nationalism. You pointed out an article where you talked about how white women in Europe need to breed to overcome an invasion of uncivilized darkies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stein gets away with keeping maybe not a foot in the white nationalist pool, but at least a few toes. And he gets away with it in part because he's not so much a good writer as he's a clever writer. And there is a difference. He's a clever writer because he has a way of saying things that would get a different writer in trouble. And Stein gets around that a lot of times by quoting other people having said something, but quoting it approvingly. But he can always fall back on saying, look, those weren't my words. That I was quoting so-and-so. I was quoting so-and-so. So he does have a way of kind of cleverly getting around it. However, not clever enough for the Canadian human rights tribunals. Several times Stein got in trouble with them. Now, anytime there's a battle between anybody and a Canadian human rights tribunal, I side with the anybody, of course, because these human rights tribunals in Canada are purely organs of the state that exist to squash free speech.
Ezra Levant, stood up to them.
People like Stein and Levant, they've stood up to the tribunals, and the tribunals, I think, have actually lost a certain amount of influence. I mean, Stein did not get charged by them. The Muslim groups twice tried to get Stein brought up on charges, and both times the tribunal, even though the tribunals in both times, they criticized Stein. They said, Stein's terrible. He's an evil, racist man. He's a terrible man. But they never charged him. I think the human rights tribunals are more and more losing their power. But Stein moved to the United States anyhow in a couple of years ago. And so he's not really even under their jurisdiction anymore. He has a lot of opinions on Mexicans for someone who doesn't and has never lived in the Southwest. I kind of joke that you don't see me going up to Canada and spouting off about the French. I might have my opinions about Quebec and French separatism and bilingualism. I might have my opinions, but I also like to try to keep in mind that I've never lived in the eastern part of Canada, and I would be more interested perhaps in learning about the situation a bit more before I tried to come off as an expert. And so Stein, as I said, he's a clever writer. However, you know, I'd invite him to actually spend a little more time in L.A. and you know, perhaps learn a bit more about the situation on the ground from people who live in the Southwest, as opposed to someone like himself who's always been a northern dweller. I'm not saying he's not entitled to his opinion. I'm just saying that sometimes it's actually good to learn a bit and listen before you start speaking, just for your own benefit as a writer.
Well, so if you look at John Derbyshire, who also writes for Tacky Mag, he never really said anything critical about Israel or Jews, but he got fired from National Review for, well, partially because of his views on mass immigration, but mainly because of an article he wrote about blacks.
Yeah. He was treated, in my opinion, very, very unfairly. National Review wimped out. They should have defended him. First of all, it doesn't even matter whether I think his column was non-offensive, partially offensive, or totally offensive. That's irrelevant. He was a member of their family, of their staff. And even if you thought, even if someone there thought that that column crossed the line, well, the man's been part of the magazine for a long time. Everybody deserves one column that you think is a misfire. I mean, everybody deserves at least one misfire. This is one of the things that is so appalling about the politically correct crowd. People live in fear of offending them because you don't get a second chance. You slip up one time, you say one thing at work that comes off as offensive. You say one thing in the heat of an argument that might be a racial epithet, and you don't get a second chance. Doesn't matter how you've lived your life or how well-liked you are or what a kind of human being you are. You don't get a second chance. National Review, in firing Derbyshire, National Review really showed itself to be quite cowardly. It should have stood by the man. Didn't mean they had to say, we love this piece that he wrote, but they should have said, well, maybe it did cross the line, but it's not a fireable offense. To me, a fireable offense, sure, if you go for months and months writing nothing but bad columns or misfires, well, every magazine has the right to let people go for that. But this idea of letting someone go who's been part of the family for a long time just because of one misfire, it's unfair. And as I said, it was very, very cowardly.
So you also, in this article, The Reich's Jewish Problem, you also point to a case where Ron, with a head of a Ron Paul meetup group in 2009, was they were banished from the California GOP convention for a cartoon that was considered offensive to Israel. I think this was by the GOP chairman, Ron Yering.
Yeah, there was at the beginning of the whole Tea Party movement in 2009, there was a Ron Paul meetup group in California, and they, on their meetup group page, they ran a cartoon. I don't know who drew the cartoons. I don't know the name of the cartoonist. I believe it was uncredited. But they ran a cartoon on their meetup page that showed American tax dollars being ground up and turning into blood, with a caption that said something along the lines of stop funding the war against the people in Gaza, something like that. And immediately the California Republican higher-ups denounced the group, banished the group, attacked the group just for this one cartoon. And it was just for that cartoon. It wasn't even for an article or text of anything. It was just for the cartoon. So, again, we get this hypocrisy where the brave mainstream conservatives and GOPs pat themselves on the back for drawing Muhammad and for Charlie Hebdo and for supporting cartoons that are offensive to Muslims. But one of the few times that anything even slightly Republican-oriented published a cartoon that was seen as offensive to Israel, the people involved were attacked verbally and banned. That is a clear hypocrisy, and there was no rush to their defense. Nobody in 2009 said, "Whoa, wait a minute! It's just a cartoon, and maybe we should look at it the same way as if the cartoon was offensive to Muslims." But nobody did that. The people of the meetup page were roundly attacked, and again, just another example of that hypocrisy from the people who like to claim that they're so brave in the face of political correctness.
So you wrote this article. This was back in May, the last ever shifting goalpost.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about your first encounters with this goalpost shifting was when you went to that majority black high school in LA in the early 1980s. And they might let us have Eddie Murphy or Michael Jackson, but some of your angrier black friends would lament that regarding how much territory the man was willing to see, but you will never see a black Miss America.
Yeah, the black kids I went to school with, a lot of them kept kind of a running catalog of the things the man will never allow. And they would always say, yeah, well, the man is going to, he'll allow us to be comedians in big movies, and he'll listen to our music, and he'll let our musicians win Grammy Awards, but you ain't never going to see a black Miss America, and you never, and then Vanessa Williams became Miss America, but then towards the end of her reign, she was dismissed because of the naked photo controversy. So that just fueled the fire. See, there was a black Miss America, and they fired her, and you're never going to see it again. And then it just became kind of routine after that. There were like two dark-skinned black Americas in a row, and then a couple more after that. And so at that point, it stopped mattering, and it was no longer, you'll never see a black Miss America. Then it became, well, you'll never see a black president. And every time that the goalpost is moved, and this is a common logical fallacy, the goalpost shifting. You claim that this is the goalpost. You claim that this is where you're staking your claim. But then when that loses effect, you move the goalpost, it becomes something else. I had a friend, a very smart person, not a dummy, very left-leaning, but still an intelligent person. And when Obama was elected, she said, well, you'll never see a fully black president. It's like, Jesus, really? That people don't see Obama as fully black? I mean, yeah, he isn't. He's mixed. But, you know, he's not exactly Harry Belafonte. but they'll always shift the goalpost. And so every time one of their goals is met, because they want to be able to keep bitching, they want to be able to keep complaining, they'll just come up with another goal. Like, for example, if we were to elect a full black man as president, that friend of mine would probably say, we'll never see a black president with dreadlocks. Huh. And they'll always find something else. There will always be some new thing.
Also applies to the whole censorship issue and selective outrage you've been discussing.
Yeah. Definitely. And it, as I said, it's kind of a common logical fallacy. I, in the piece that you mentioned, I apply it to global warming and to all of the goalposts that have not been met. In 2000, New York will be underwater. No, actually, in 2005, New York will be underwater. No, 2008, New York will be underwater. And every time the goal isn't met, they just shift it. They just move it further down the field. But, yeah, it also definitely applies to the political correctness issue and a lot of things. These kind of fallacies are used by ideologues for many, many reasons.
So you have this post, Aryan Psycho Killers and Me. So you wrote this after the Charleston shooting, but you were in communication with a famous shooter back in 93.
Yeah, in 93, when I was David Cole and I was doing revisionism full-time, this fellow who I didn't know, who I'd never met, started leaving messages on my voicemail number. This is back before cell phones, so I only had two ways to contact me. I had my landline, and then I had a 1-800 voicemail number, something that I could give out to people that didn't lead back to my home in any way. So my voicemail messages, they started to come in from this guy who identified himself as Jonathan Haynes. I didn't know how he got my number. I would find out many years later that Bradley Smith, the revisionist activist and free speech activist, Bradley Smith had given him my number, not knowing that Haynes was kind of a dark soul. But the messages that Haynes was leaving on my voicemail, they were crazy. I mean, they were just... they were so out there that I saved them And I don't even know why I saved them. I think, to be honest, I saved them because they were entertaining. He had this twisted notion that there was a Jewish conspiracy to keep him from getting laid. I found that to be funny. I had no idea that he was actually, while he was leaving those messages, he was going across the country killing people. He had determined, I guess, there had been a couple times where he had tried to date a woman thinking she was pure-blooded Aryan, and it turned out that he had been fooled by colored contact lenses or hair dye. So he was going across the country trying to kill people who produce colored contact lenses or hairdressers who lighten people's hair. He called them, he said they were making fake Aryans. And he committed some murders in California and then committed some more murders when he got to Illinois. Eventually he was caught and he's on death row. Now he's on death row in Illinois, and I know they tried to convict him as well in California, and I don't actually remember whether they did, whether he's also on death row here. But I still had those messages, those voicemail messages. I saved them, and when I found out that he had been arrested...
Are you legally allowed to upload them to YouTube, or are there legal issues with that?
No, I can do whatever I want, because since it was a voicemail, he knew he was being recorded, and so it's not surreptitious. It was not illegal in any way. The problem is, I can't find the tapes. I would put them on YouTube in a minute, but when I transcribed them for Haynes' lawyers for the California version of the trial, and then I gave the transcription and a copy of the tape to a publisher, Adam Parfrey, the guy who would end up later on publishing my own book. So I gave the transcript to several people. I gave a copy of the tape to both parties, to the lawyers and also to Adam Parfrey. I can't find the originals. I mean, I've got so many boxes of old audio tapes from the 80s and 90s. I haven't gone through them all to find it yet. I'd like to put it on YouTube. If I could find it, it would be put online immediately, and there's a lot of people who have asked me to do that. I called my publisher, and I said, you wouldn't happen to know where that audio tape I gave you in 1994 is, and he kind of laughed at me. I guess the notion that he could find something like that from 20 years ago. So none of us can find the tapes. We only have the transcript. When I find the tape, I will definitely put it online.
And so we're getting towards the end, so I guess one last post. You just won Latinas in the field.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of, if I remember correctly, what was her name? There was this very angry Mexican-American writer who used to write for the L.A. Times, very angry, very unreasonable, and it's really full of hate. Everything that she would write about for the L.A. Times, she had the Latin music beat for the entertainment section of the L.A. Times. And everything she would write would in one way or another be about how white people are doing this wrong. White people think they can dance to this music, but this is Latino music. White people think that they appreciate this music, but only a Latino can appreciate this music. And it was just full of lots and lots of anger. And then she got fired from the Times, and she went on a racist tirade. They only fired her because she's Latino, which is very silly. If you know the LA Times, they have tons of Latino writers, most of whom are a little out there, a little extreme. And eventually she ended up getting a huge book deal, like a $500,000 advance, and writing like teenage literature for Hispanic girls, but then eventually she accused the publisher of racism. Somebody tried to make one of her books into a movie. I think it was NBC. It was one of the networks. She accused them of racism, and she's one of these perennially angry people. Elisa Valdez is her name, and she just represents that type of quote-unquote minority activist who is always furious, and everything that goes wrong in her life, always she traces it back to evil white people, no matter what it is. I'm sure she's the kind of person who curses white people if she burns the toast in the morning. Always something, and it always has to do with white people. So I had been corresponding back and forth with her for a long time, probably since 2000 or 1999. And something relevant happened when I wrote that piece for Tacky's that allowed me to bring her up. And I apologize to you and your listeners. I don't actually remember what it was that got me interested in that piece, what, you know, what my main point in that piece, other than talking about the history of this very angry woman.
So we're out of time, but I guess what else do you want to add before I wrap up the show? I guess pretty much the overall theme of the show is censorship and selective outrage. That's pretty much a good way to put it.
I encourage people to visit Tacky Mag as much as they can, for all the writers, not just for me. The thing I like about Tacky's is they have a small stable of regulars. Most of them only do one piece a week, so it's not one of these high-volume blog sites. You're not going to go to Tacky's if you want to find out one of those three-paragraph news items about what the Pope did today or what Obama said today. The writers there, they try to put a lot into every piece that they do. I certainly try to put a lot into my weekly pieces. So I would encourage your listeners to visit Tacky's and to explore everybody who writes for the site. And for me, my theme usually does come back to going against political correctness. And a lot of times when people ask me what's my most important thing as a conservative, since I've never been big into battling over gay marriage or some of the social issues. My most important thing as a conservative has always been the fight against political correctness, which is one of the reasons that I got so upset when conservatives began banning me for being too politically incorrect. I thought I had found a group of friends and a group of colleagues who agreed with me on the whole anti-PC thing, but I turned out to be very wrong about that.
It's kind of like the new, are you familiar with the new conservative meme?
Oh, sure, yeah, I've been following the use and origin of that. It's a controversial thing, but I think there is a kind of a split more and more that is coming. We were talking about how Mark Stein does keep a couple toes in the white nationalist water, and eventually I think you'll see more infighting over just how far to go or how politically correct. I think there are some conservatives who want a little more political correctness in conservatism, and certainly there are Republicans who think that adding a little more PC might help them win elections. I don't agree with that, but I think there are people who feel that way, and I think these are controversies we'll be hearing more and more about.
Well, David Cole, it's been a great show.
It's always a pleasure, Robert. Anytime, have me on. It's always a lot of fun.
Thanks for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.